Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Carol Malone, the chair of the Board of Trustees, and it's my great pleasure tonight to present Dr. Daniel Pop. His lecture is inspired by our exhibition, which is right outside here in the Peluso Family Exhibition Area, and it's called Broken Beauty, Ruins of the Ancient World. It's curated by our very own curator, Harriet Shapiro, to whom we're very grateful for all her hard work. The title of Dr. Pott's talk intrigues me. Ancient Iran, in the medieval Renaissance and early modern consciousness of Europe, the printed word, the graven image, the learned traveler, and the stage. And when I thought about this, I thought, well, you know, he's obviously chosen his words very deliberately, because the printed word, so we're not talking about calligraphy, which many of us would associate with this part of the world. The graven image, so not painted, for example. The learned traveler, so not those of us who travel, you know, just on a 10-day jaunt. So people who really knew what they were, really knew what their, probably the foreign language that they were going to explore. The stage, plays and opera inspired by this period. The theme of the talk, of course, is Persia or Iran, was an object of enormous interest in the West long before the excavations of Persepolis. The early curiosity of these early travelers is captured not only in hundreds of books and engravings that circulated for Europe, around Europe from the 1400s right through the 1700s, but also in plays and in operas centered on the lives of, among others, Persian emperors. Dr. Potts is a specialist in the archaeology and early history of Iran and Mesopotamia and the Arabian Peninsula. He's the founding editor of the journal Arabian Archaeology and Epigraphy, a corresponding member of the Instituto Italiano per il Medio ed Estremo Oriente, and a corresponding member of the German Archaeological Institute. His latest book, a new edition of the Archaeology of Elam, Formation and Transformation of an Ancient Iranian State, was published by Cambridge University Press in 2016. And his previous book on nomadism in Iran was published by Oxford University Press in 2014 and was awarded an honorable mention in the 2015 Prose Awards, which are annual awards for publications of outstanding scholarship. Dr. Potts received his doctorate from Harvard in 1980 and has since then taught at the Free University of Berlin, the University of Copenhagen for 22 years at the University of Sydney. In 2014, he and his family returned to the United States, and there he assumed his current position as professor of ancient Near Eastern archaeology and history at the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World at New York University. And he has kindly agreed to take questions after his talk. On a personal note, I met Dan Potts when our sons were undergraduates together at Harvard. His oldest son had, in, as a teenager, written an American newspaper when they lived in Yemen, which I thought was really one of the, you know, really took the cake for the outstanding item to put on your college application. And we're fortunate to have his youngest son here with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Daniel Potts.
I'm going to be reading this lecture simply because there are quite a few names and dates and things that I don't have necessarily on the tip of my tongue, and I want to move through quite a bit of material. I thought I would be covering more, in fact, but within the compass of an hour, just under an hour, I only get up to the early 18th century. So I apologize, there's a lot more to say about the latter late 18th and, of course, 19th century, but this is more than enough for one night, I think. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow book lovers, it's an honor to be with you tonight and to be given the opportunity to indulge several of my long-standing interests, pre-Islamic Iran and the intellectual history of scholarship about a part of the world that has fascinated me for many years. Tonight, as Carol said, I'm going to be touching on a series of topics that concern early Western interest in pre-Islamic Iran, from the medieval era to the early 18th century. The focus is first on Latin and Greek sources on Iran that were available in Europe before the earliest eyewitness accounts of the country became available or were published. Second, the graven image, that is, illustrations of pre-Islamic Iranian monuments published in Western sources from the late 15th to the early 18th century. Third, the learned traveler, that is, visitors to Iran, who wrote about its sites and monuments, with a focus tonight, again, for time purposes, reasons, only on Persepolis. And finally, theatrical and operatic treatments of ancient Iran and Europe from the beginnings of Elizabethan tragedy in the 16th century to Italian opera of the 17th and 18th centuries. With these preliminaries out of the way, let's take a look at the biblical and classical sources that first exposed European readers and illiterate churchgoers to the peoples of ancient Iran. The conversion of Europe's many diverse peoples to Christianity exposed a large number of Europeans to the old Latin Bible, or Vetus Latina, which was quickly superseded by St. Jerome's Latin translation known as the Vulgate in the late 4th century. This was an important source on pre-Islamic Iran. For example, the principal events described in the Book of Esther take place at Susa, or Shushan the Palace, in the province of Elam, a place that I've worked on a lot. A major site, Susa is a major site in southwestern Iran that has been excavated off and on since the mid-19th century. Elam figures prominently in the Book of Jeremiah, and Jews from Elam were present in Jerusalem at Pentecost, according to the Book of Acts. The Medes and Persians are also present in the Old Testament, as are both Cyrus the Great, founder of the Persian Empire, and his successor, not his immediate successor, Darius the First. But while the Old and New Testament preserve some intelligence on pre-Islamic Iran, the Bible has only a minuscule amount of information compared to the classical sources. Now, you might think, because it dwells so much on the Persian Empire, that Herodotus's histories would have been the primary source of European knowledge about Iran before printing was invented in 1464. But Herodotus wrote in Greek, a language that very few people in medieval Europe could read, as illustrated by the presence of only 9 manuscripts of Herodotus in Greek dating from the 10th through the 14th century in all of Europe's libraries. Latin's much greater currency was guaranteed because it was the language of the Roman Church. As the Belgian medievalist Marc Loris put it, quote, "The Latin language was endowed with a sacred dimension that surpassed the confines of temporal history and gave it an inherent and timeless prevalence over all other languages." In this situation, therefore, educated Western readers were much more likely to be introduced to ancient Iran by texts in Latin than by Greek authors like Herodotus. One such Latin text was Pliny's Natural History, which dates to the mid-first century AD and contains an enormous amount of information on matters Iranian. Dozens of manuscripts are known, dating back to the 5th century. The Encyclopedist Bartholomaeus Anglicus, or Bartholomew the Englishman, who wrote his De Proprietatibus Rerum on the properties of things around 1230, drew heavily on Pliny. And we can gauge the use of a work like this in scholarly circles by looking at the libraries of some of the Cambridge and Oxford colleges. Merton knew Balliol and All Souls at Oxford, and Clare Hall, Peterhouse, Gonville, and Jesus Colleges at Cambridge all possessed copies of De Proprietatibus, so they were not rare in English universities. Herodotus's histories and Strabo's geography, both of which contain a wealth of information on Iran, did not then become generally available until Latin translations had been made of them. Happily, however, This quickly followed the invention of printing, as I mentioned, in 1464. Printed editions of both Herodotus and Strabo appeared in 1469 and 1474, respectively, whereas a printed edition of Herodotus in the original Greek was not published until the early 16th century. Similarly, Quintus Curtius's Life of Alexander the Great, a work containing an enormous amount of intelligence on the Persian Empire in its final years, was printed as early as 1470 or 1471, followed in 1533 by a critical edition with commentary and extensive notes by no less a giant of Renaissance humanism than Desiderius Erasmus. The publication of more classical texts relevant to ancient Iran followed quickly and gave rise to analytical and synthetic works like Barnabé Brisson's De Regio Persarum on the Kingdom of the Persians, published in 1591. This extraordinary work, which I have used, synthesizes virtually everything contained in the Greek and Latin literary sources on ancient Persian political history, ethnography, religion, and culture. Similarly, Filippo Ferrari's two geographical dictionaries list alphabetically every single ancient place name mentioned in Greek and Latin sources, not epigraphic sources, that is, inscriptions that were only discovered later, but the literary sources that were published by this point. The reason this is important is that by the time European travelers began to visit Iran in larger numbers, as diplomats, clerics, and merchants with an antiquarian bent, we can safely say that the most important ancient Greek and Latin texts concerning Iran and secondary literature like these geographical compendia were available. Indeed, a copy of Ferrari's Epitome Geographicum of 1605, like the one you see here on the left, was carried by the well-known Italian traveler Pietro della Valle, who spent almost 5 years in Iran from early 1617 to late 1621. On his way to Iran, Della Valle spent across the Ottoman Empire, and when he arrived at Isfahan, it was his dearest wish to persuade Shah Abbas I, the reigning monarch of the time of the Safavid Empire, to launch a crusade against the Ottomans, for whom he had developed a strong dislike while traveling through their territory. In fact, Shah Abbas was away. He was off on campaign when Della Valle arrived, and Della Valle had to go and find him. This inconvenience was, however, compensated for the fact, by the fact that, as a result, Della Valle saw a good part of northern Iran, and his letters are replete with references to ancient place names, the existence of which he knew from his reading of ancient authors, including Herodotus and Xenophon, both of whom had been translated from Greek into Latin by the end of the 15th century. One of the clearest extant expressions of devotion to the classical sources on Iran by early modern travelers comes from Jean Chardin, a French Huguenot jeweler who first visited Iran in 1666. Chardin was commissioned by Shah Abbas II to purchase jewels for him, and he spent 4 years from 1673 to 1677 in the Safavid capital, Isfahan. His multi-volume travel account was highly praised by such Enlightenment luminaries as Gibbon, Montesquieu, and Rousseau. In Chardin's opinion, as this quote says, nothing was easier than recognizing the situation of Persepolis in the descriptions of Arrian, Quintus Curtius, and Diodorus. And he expressed his pleasure at traveling the countryside with copies of these ancient authors to hand. But late Renaissance and early modern travelers had more than the classical sources on their minds as they journeyed through Iran. In 1577, the Swiss philosopher and physician, Theodor Zwinger, published his Methodus Apodemica, which, as the Italian scholar Lucia Felici has said, quote, was immediately recognized as a model for the practice and theory of travel. Svinger aimed at instructing travelers so that they would profit as much as possible from the experience. In the four large books of the Methodus Apodemica, he furnished a scientific method with which all the practical aspects of travel could be analyzed, urging travelers to examine political and institutional configurations as well as the physical and cultural features of the lands they visited. Thus, apodemic literature offered the traveler a roadmap, a blueprint, systematic rules for travel and observation. In the specific case of Iran and the Near East more broadly, therefore, it is no coincidence that we have such a rich legacy of travel literature from the 16th century onwards. Rather, this was the product of a concerted effort by travelers actively employing what we could call the Svinger method. With respect to pre-Islamic Iran, no ancient site received more attention from Western observers than Persepolis, the Persian capital founded by Darius I around 520 BC. The site, as it appears today, is certainly impressive, with its many residential, reception, and administrative buildings, all of which sit atop a massive platform measuring about 300 by 455 meters, 12 meters in height, made of thousands and thousands of tons of stone. And although the appearance of Persepolis today owes much to excavations undertaken in the 20th century, it has never been entirely buried by debris, in spite of the best efforts of Alexander and his army to destroy it. We know this not only because of the many views of the site published from the 17th century onwards, long before any excavations took place, but also from inscriptions dated to late antiquity and the early medieval era on the standing ruins of buildings that were never covered by debris. The earliest such inscription, written in the language we call Middle Persian, dates to the year 311 AD, that is about 600 years after the burning of Persepolis by the Macedonian army. Inscribed on a door frame that stands to this day, the inscription records a visit by Shapur, son of Ormazd II, the reigning Shahan Shah, king of kings of the Sasanian Empire. Shapur stopped to eat at Persepolis while traveling to eastern Iran, where he was governor, having paid a visit to his father. And the text clearly implies that he does not know who built Persepolis or how old the site was. Another example of such royal graffiti was left in the 10th century by Abd al-Dawla, a king of the Buyid dynasty who visited in 955. He commanded that someone be brought before him who could read the inscriptions visible on the ruins of the site. Now, it is certain that nobody living in the 10th century could have read the accumulated inscriptions written in cuneiform, which we'll see some examples of in a few moments. But scribes or government secretaries, many of whom were Zoroastrians, could read Middle Persian, the liturgical language of Zoroastrianism, and the language used by Shapur in the text of 311 that we just saw. In fact, a second inscription left by Abd al-Dawla shows us that indeed two literate men were found who presumably read the Middle Persian text of Shapur. One of the literati in question was named Marasfand al-Mobad. Mobad means magus, or Zoroastrian priest, and his surname, so to speak, al-Khazaruni, shows that he came from the city of Khazarun, a town that still bears this name, south of Persepolis, not too far from the Persian Gulf. As I noted a moment ago, by the time Shapur had his graffito written in the early 4th century, the identity of the original builders of Persepolis was unknown. And with time, the Achaemenid Empire passed into the realm of myth. Around 999 AD, the great Persian poet Ferdowsi completed his Book of Kings, or Shahnameh. And there, Persepolis is called Takht-i Jamshid, the throne of Jamshid, one of the early and most illustrious mythical rulers of the Iranians, a figure often conflated with Solomon in the Hebrew Bible. Now, the first known European visitor to the site was the Franciscan friar Odoric of Pordenone, who saw Persepolis in 1330. Odoric mistakenly thought its inhabitants had fought with the Romans rather than Alexander and his Macedonians. However, although he called the site Homerund and exaggerated its size, talking about its walls a good 50 miles in circumference, the description of its standing walls and palaces has been taken by most commentators to apply to Persepolis, and frankly, there would be very few other sites that it could apply to. Almost a century and a half passed before another European visitor, the Venetian ambassador Josefa Barbaro, visited Persepolis. Barbaro began his eastern journey in 1436 and published an account of his travels in 1467, just 3 years after the invention of printing. He called the site Sil Minar, which is an easily recognizable transliteration of Persian Chehel Minar, meaning 40 columns, a colloquial name for Persepolis. Barbaro described the monumental columns, 20 yards tall, he said, so thick that it would take three men to wrap their arms around them, clearly exaggerated. He also described, quote, an image like unto that we resemble to God the Father in a circle, which clearly corresponds to this figure, the figure of Ahura Mazda, the great god of Zoroastrianism and titular deity of the Persian Achaemenid dynasty. This is an image that appears many times in Persepolis and elsewhere. When Barbaro made his visit to Persepolis, Fars province, where Persepolis is located, was under the control of the Akkuyunlu Confederation, a tribal empire created by Turkmen, which lasted only a matter of decades. In 1476, the governor of Fars province, Sultan Khalil, a son of the Akkuyunlu ruler, Uzun Hasan, one of whose coins we see here, visited the site. Sultan Khalil's court poet was along for the ride. His name is Davani, and he says that Sultan Khalil, quote, gave orders to Prince Abul Ma'ali Sultan Ali Mirza, a great expert in calligraphy, to carve a few lines of appropriate poetry on one of the buildings at Persepolis, so kind of high-class graffiti. Amazingly, the lines that Sultan Khalil had engraved were copied almost two centuries later by the English East India Company agent Samuel Flower when he visited the site in 1667. And these lines were published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society in London in 1693. You can see here, these are the lines that Davani composed and which were inscribed, carved by the calligrapher they had with them. You also see down here what looks like an inscription in Old Persian cuneiform. In fact, this writing system was not deciphered until the 1840s. So when Flower's copy was published in 1693, nobody realized that this was not an inscription at all, but a collection of randomly copied signs from different monuments at Persepolis. But Flower was in fact not the first visitor who was guilty of such a deception. That honor belongs to Don Garcia de Silva y Figueroa, ambassador of Philip III, king of the Spanish monarchy. He was the ambassador to the Safavid ruler Shah Abbas I, whom I've already mentioned. Don Garcia copied several signs at Persepolis in 1618, you see up here. But these were not included in the Dutch diplomat Abraham de Vicfort's 1667 French translation of Don Garcia's travel account, and were only published in 1903, when this edition of Don Garcia's account was published in Spain. Don Garcia's original manuscript is in the National Library in Madrid. You see part of it up at the top of this slide. And it contains a dozen or so drawings, probably made by his secretary. Although not the work of a very competent draftsman, the drawings are nonetheless faithful enough to enable us to relatively easily identify the the actual relief in question that he was drawing, such as this famous one showing a seated king, variously identified as Darius with his crown prince Xerxes behind him, or as Xerxes seated with his crown prince Artaxerxes I behind the throne. Similarly, this drawing of a Persian courtier or usher holding a baton or a walking stick and wearing the so-called Elamite dagger with its very distinctive shape here is a figure represented many times at Persepolis. As I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, the Italian traveler Pietro della Valle wrote an important travel account which included a description of his visit to Persepolis in 1621. In fact, the fanciful drawing of what looks like a door frame here, with oversized cuneiform in Old Persian, is again composed of random signs and does not represent an actual inscription. But this was the very first cuneiform of any kind published in the West, appearing long before Flower's copies, which, as I said, were not published until 1693. Della Valle was the first in a long line of travelers who reported on Persepolis. Just 5 years after his visit, in 1626, Thomas Herbert, only 21 at the time, accompanied an embassy sent by Charles I to Shah Abbas under Sir Dodmore Cotton, who was effectively the very first English ambassador to Iran. Cotton was charged with negotiating a trade agreement between England and the Safavid Empire. Only 7 years later, Herbert published an account of his journey. That's the book you see here in the middle of the slide. And this is a book that generations of historians have praised for its spontaneity and acute perspective. And then 40 years later, he brought out this revised work, much expanded, which has not been as well received by modern historians because of the fact that it is much more studied and embellished. But it is of greater interest to us, as it includes a long account of Herbert's visit to both Persepolis and Pasargadae, the capital founded, another city founded by Cyrus the Great. Herbert devoted over 13 pages of very closely printed text to a lengthy discussion of what he saw, and his work incorporates a very learned discussion of what the ancient sources had to say about Persepolis and the Persian Empire more generally. And this was clearly the product of study and research conducted after his initial visit. He too copied some random cuneiform signs, and in addition to consulting all of the relevant classical sources, he also mentions explicitly at the end of this paragraph that he used Ferrari's Epitome, the lexicon of place names and classical texts that I mentioned a little while ago. In 1636, Friedrich III, Duke of Schleswig-Holstein-Gottorp, whom you see here, sent a trading mission to Iran. An ambitious and highly capable ruler who had already dispatched a delegation to Russia to explore the possibility of importing luxury goods from the East without having to cross the Ottoman Empire, a kind of a back channel. The Duke lived on this sumptuous estate, which I had the pleasure of visiting a few years ago, in northern Germany, that is today about 40 minutes drive north of Kiel, close to and about half an hour from the Danish border. The delegation sent to Iran included two members whose publications have remained of enormous interest since their first appearance, namely the mathematician and orientalist Adam Oehlschläger, better known by his Latinized surname Olearius, as secretary, and Johann Albrecht von Mandelsloh, a 17-year-old nobleman. Although the account of the mission published by Olearius in 1647 is important, very important, for historians, for the light it sheds on contemporary political and social conditions in Iran, that of his younger colleague, Mandelsloh, is of greater interest for us, as it reports, among other things, on a visit to Persepolis made on 27 January 1638. Published posthumously by Olearius 14 years after Mandelsloh's death, and incorporating content cribbed from Thomas Herbert's earlier account, The Morgan Lendisher risical tribal, nevertheless, did include an interesting detail, namely that when Mandelslot visited Persepolis, 19 columns in the audience, in the great audience hall of Darius the First, were still standing. In 1649, the Dutch East India Company sent Johan Cuneus as ambassador to the court of Shah Abbas II in Isfahan. Both the Dutch and the English after them were mainly interested in acquiring Persian silk, which they transported overland from the Safavid capital, Isfahan, to Bandarbas on the Persian Gulf, where it was loaded onto vessels bound for India, and from India shipped back to the Netherlands. 19-year-old Cornelis Janszoon Spielman accompanied Cuneus as his secretary. In 1908, Spielman's journal was published by the Dutch businessman Albertus Hotz, who spent 30 years working in Iran and knew the country intimately. And he also actually created an amazing archive of photographs from the late 19th century. Spielman's observations were very detailed, noting the heights and diameters of columns, how many steps were preserved in various staircases, the dimensions of buildings, and so forth, giving much more precise information than any of his predecessors had done. Although, as I noted, Spielman's diary was only published centuries after his visit and included neither drawings nor plans of Persepolis. The next important visitor to the site was the Frenchman Jean de Thévenot. Thévenot had already traveled extensively throughout the Eastern Mediterranean, Egypt, and Sinai between 1656 and 1659. And he's even credited with having introduced coffee to Paris. After publishing the first volume of his travels, which you see here, and which got translated into English from the original French, he set off for India via Iran in 1663. Fluent in Turkish, Arabic, and Persian, Thévenot is highly regarded for his accurate portrayal of Persian daily life and institutions. Although he died on his return at the age of only 34, his work was published posthumously in 1674. On his visit to Persepolis, Thévenot was accompanied by the French gem merchant Jean-Baptiste Tavernier. Tavernier openly expressed his disdain for the ruins of Persepolis, but he had in his service the Dutch artist Philips Ango. He's called the second because, amazingly, there's another contemporary Dutch artist named Philips Ango, who would have thought. Angle had gone to Iran in 1651 as part of a Dutch East India Company delegation expressly to teach Shah Abbas II how to draw. And he wrote a theoretical work on painting, so he was a sort of didactically inclined as well as being a practical artist. Angle spent 8 days at Persepolis, and it has been suggested that this was done at the behest of Shah Abbas II, who wanted him to document the ruins there. The view of Persepolis that you see here, published in François Valentin's Old and New India in 1726, was actually done by Angle, although for many years it was wrongly attributed to another Dutchman, Herbert de Jager, who worked for the Dutch East India Company between 1665 and 1670, and again from 1684 to 1687. And de Jager's work at Persepolis has survived as well. In 1691, Nicholas Witsen, mayor of Amsterdam and a Dutch East India Company officer, sent these two drawings of Persepolis by de Jager to the Royal Society in London. The upper one shows the approach to the site from the south, looking north. The lower one is an oblique bird's eye view from the north, looking south. In 1694, these were published in the Royal Society's journal Philosophical Transactions, with a preamble by the editor, who justified their publication by noting that, quote, little of those famous remains having been yet published, and those that have been but ill-designed or graved. In March 1672, yet another Dutchman, Jan Janszoon Strauss, visited Persepolis. A sailmaker by profession, He ran away from home and made three adventurous voyages, the first of which took him to Iran. Probably a shock to his parents. His illustration of the so-called royal tomb of Persepolis, Tombo Royal, perhaps at least, shows a highly fanciful building with multiple domes and garlands. And the only kernels of truth in it seem to be the raised platform on which the whole architectural ensemble is sited, and the freestanding columns, which at least bear some resemblance to reality. In his 2008 study, The Fiction and Reality of Jan Struys, the Dutch scholar Kees Butterbloom noted, quote, wholly unexpected from an unsophisticated sailor, classical Greek authorities are invoked in his book Rising. These erudite references reveal a ghostwriter well-versed in the classics, and it may be, too, that the embellished drawing of Persepolis, vigorously criticized by Chardin, owes nothing to Struys but more to the publisher or his ghostwriter. Roughly 2 years later, in July 1674, 25-year-old Ambrosio Bembo arrived at Persepolis. Bembo was a young Venetian nobleman whose family palazzo still stands, as you see here. In 1669, at the age of only 17, he fought in Venice's naval wars against the Ottomans, serving under his relatives Taddeo Morosini, commander of the Venetian Navy, and Taddeo's brother, Francesco Morosini, commander-in-chief of all the Venetian forces in the Venetian-Ottoman War, and later Doge of Venice. When Bembo's uncle Marco was appointed consul for Venice in Aleppo, he invited Ambrosio to accompany him to Syria, and thus began the peregrinations that would take him all the way to India and back. The fact that Bembo left a detailed diary was not known until 1803, when Jacopo Morelli, the librarian of St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice, published excerpts of it in this dissertation on the journeys of some erudite Venetians. Between 1803 and 1964, the book was in private hands, the diary was in private hands, but in 1964, it was acquired by the Rare Book Library at the University of Minnesota. And in 2007, it was published by the University of California Press in an English translation on which the Safavid and Mughal art historian Anthony Welch worked. What makes Bembo's journal of particular interest in this instance is not so much the text, which is very terse on the subject of Persepolis, but rather the illustrations accompanying it. When Bembo was in Isfahan, he met the wealthy French jeweler I've already mentioned before, Jean Chardin. Chardin was already known for his eyewitness account of the coronation of the Safavid Shah Suleiman, and he was, by all accounts, both haughty and devious. Chardin had employed the French artist Pion-Joseph Grelot to illustrate what would be his magnum opus, Voyage de Monsieur le Chevalier Chardin en Perse, published in four volumes. But when Bembo met him, Grelot was suffering under a stringent contract that made him surrender all rights to his drawings to his patron Chardin, imposing harsh penalties if he didn't finish the job or if the drawings weren't up to snuff, and withholding all payment until Chardin and Grelot had returned to Paris. In need of an artist himself, Bembo managed to lure Grelot away, in part because he offered to pay Grelot's return passage to Paris, something that Chardin was unwilling to do. Grelot himself eventually published an important work on Constantinople, but the drawing you see here, Persepolis, for example, was a composite made on the basis of both Grelot's and Bembo's recollections and sketches drawn during their visit to Persepolis. Grelot's pencil drawing of the tomb of Artaxerxes, the second of Persepolis, the real thing is there to your left in the photograph, his drawing is here in the middle, is very faithful in most details, and is clearly the precursor of the engraving on the right, which appeared in Chardin's Voyage in 1711. Along with other drawings published by Chardin, this suggests, I would say, that despite their contretemps, Grelot nevertheless did fulfill his contractual obligations to Chardin. In March 1684, the German physician Engelbert Kempfer, who had settled in Sweden in 1681, arrived in the Safavid capital Isfahan with a Swedish delegation sent to investigate potential Eastern trade. He spent the next 20 months there and proved himself an acute observer of all aspects of Persian society. When the Swedish delegation returned home, Kempfer decided to stay on, eventually taking up a position as surgeon with the Dutch East India Company. Before taking up his duties at Bandrabas on the Persian Gulf, Kempfer spent 3 days studying the ruins of Persepolis in early December 1685. Although a medical man by profession, Kempfer's drafting ability was considerable. In 1710, his Ammonitatum Exoticarum, which might be translated as Exotic Delights, was published, containing an important series of images of Persepolis. In fact, in the lower left-hand corner down here, and there in the detail of this drawing, we can see Kempfer himself. He's sketching ruins while his servant holds his horse. Kempfer's work contains a number of features which none of his predecessors could lay, to which none of his predecessors could lay claim, such as an actual plan, which you see here, showing the disposition of the buildings on the terrace of Persepolis. The spatial relationship between the buildings and their state of preservation is shown in this isometric view, again with the figure of Kempfer sitting on the hill, the high hillside to the north of the site where the tomb of Artaxerxes was carved. Nevertheless, poor Kempfer was criticized by several later visitors to the site who considered his drawings highly inaccurate. However, most of this inaccuracy, as we see in the published work, can be attributed probably to Kempfer's engraver, A.W. Branshagen, who worked, not very well it seems, from Kempfer's original pencil drawings. In fact, Kempfer openly complained of Branshagen's clumsiness in the introduction to his book. This clumsiness is perhaps most evident in the rendering of Kempfer's figural drawings, an example of which you see here on the left. The stairways leading to the main audience hall at Persepolis are adorned with multiple registers showing gift or tribute bearers from the various satrapies of the empire. Kempfer's drawing is a composite, however, since nowhere on the site are there that many superimposed registers. Nonetheless, if we examine the images closely, we can easily recognize what Kempfer or Branshagen was trying to depict. If we take, for example, the often repeated motif of the lion attacking the bull, you see a photograph up here, and up there you can see the actual drawing in the second register. We see that the artist has completely reoriented the bull, at the same time making it into something that rather resembles a long-eared mule or donkey, while the body of the attacking lion is raised completely off the ground, as if in the act of leaping on its prey, when in fact the photograph shows that the lion's rear legs are firmly planted on the ground and the bull's body is oriented in the opposite direction with its head turned to the rear. Another example of distortion is shown here in that central panel, where sadly the artist has turned a two-humped Bactrian camel into a one-humped dromedary. And he's also seriously altered the gift bearers in front, just as he has taken liberties with the delegation in this third example down here, the delegation advancing in front of a zebu or humped bull, so Indian kind of bull. Here too, the delegation advancing in front of the zebu wear clearly cone-shaped hats with long tassels. The artist has the tassels, but otherwise has rather distorted the headgear. The most outspoken critic of the Kempfer-Branshagen etchings was the Dutch artist Cornelis de Bruyn, also known as Francis Cornet de Bruyn, one of whose works is included in the Broken Beauty exhibition outside. Several years after Kepler's work appeared, de Bruyn published a critique of both Chardin's, that is Graelot's, and Kempfer's, or Brandhagen's, illustrations of Persepolis. Arguably the most important and certainly, artistically speaking, highly trained of the 17th and 18th century visitors to Persepolis, de Bruyn was both a skilled painter draftsman and an avid traveler. After studying with Theodor van der Schuur in The Hague, de Bruyn caught the attention of Nicholas Witsen, the mayor of Amsterdam and Dutch East India Company official who, as mentioned earlier, sent Herbert de Jager's drawings to the Royal Society. Witsen has been called by his biographer, Marion Peters, the Mercator Sapiens par excellence, the wise merchant who seeks counsel and science to benefit his business. Witsen financed de Bruyn's first decade-long trip, encompassing 4 years in Italy and 6 in Turkey and Egypt. At the conclusion of this first trip, de Bruyn returned to Italy, studying painting in Venice for 8 years with the prolific German artist Johann Karl Lott, who eventually rose to become court painter for the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold I. De Bruyn returned to The Hague in 1693 and spent the next 5 years preparing his first travel book, published in 1698, which you see here. In 1701, he left on a second journey, lasting more than 7 years, to Russia, Iran, and Southeast Asia. Again, Witsen financed the journey, ostensibly because of Dutch East India Company commercial interests in Russia. De Bruyn arrived in Iran on July 21st, 1703, and stayed for nearly a year, during which time he met the last Safavid ruler of Iran, Shah Sultan Hussein. The book which resulted from this journey, first published in Dutch in 1711, did not add anything particularly novel by way of descriptions of Persian life, but it contained 320 engravings that were a major achievement and displayed de Bruyn's skill to great effect. To cite just one example of his accuracy, I have here juxtaposed de Bruyn's drawing of the relief showing the tribute bearers and the lion bull combat with, again, the photograph of the actual thing and for Brandhagen's version, which is rather deficient when you compare it with this really almost photographic drawing. Or consider the perspective of the view shown above, which is almost photographic in its depiction of the terrace at Persepolis. Moreover, if you look at the detail of the structure of two human-headed winged bulls, identified by the cuneiform inscription on it as the Gate of All Nations, the grand portal constructed by Xerxes in the 5th century, through which all delegations visiting Persepolis must have passed after climbing the stairs to the terrace, you can see just how accurate a draftsman he is. And it was here, by the way, on one of these bulls, that de Bruyn carved his name and the date of his visit, 1704. All in all, the engravings of de Bruyn surpassed the quality of anything done at Persepolis prior to the 19th century. They gave European readers a clear, realistic impression of the ruins of the palaces and audience halls of Darius the Great, Xerxes, and Artaxerxes I. Thanks to de Bruyn, Persepolis moved from the realm of the fabulous to the real, and long before the age of photography, European readers were afforded an accurate rendering of its monuments. Meanwhile, in tandem with the publication of eyewitness descriptions of Persepolis and other ancient sites associated with the Persian Empire, plays and operas, drawing on the relevant Greek and Latin sources about which I spoke earlier, increasingly made the Persian kingdom of kings known to patrons of the theater and the opera in Europe. In 1558, Queen Elizabeth I came to the throne, that around Christmas, 1560, Thomas Preston's A Lamentable Tragedy, mixed full of pleasant mirth, containing the life of Cambyses, king of Persia, was performed at her court. This means that what has been called the first Elizabethan tragedy, in fact, concerned the Persian Empire and its second king, Cambyses, son and successor of Cyrus the Great. 5 years later, an anonymous play entitled A Pretty New Interlude, both pithy and pleasant, of the story of King Darius appeared, followed in 1575 by Richard Farrant's Xerxes. The Wars of Cyrus, King of Persia, was performed in London at the Blackfriars Theatre, which Farrant owned, around 1578, and may have been written by him as well. William Alexander, 1st Earl of Stirling, wrote a rhyming tragedy of Darius, one of his so-called monarchic tragedies, in about 1603. The Restoration witnessed an explosion of plays that reflected Dutch, French, English, and Ottoman aspirations to universal monarchy and global power, and stressed the concept of translatio imperii, the passage of imperial power from one nation to another throughout history. This is well expressed in Elkanah Settle's dedication of the play Cambyses, produced in 1671, to the Duke and Duchess of Monmouth, when he wrote, quote, "Once Persia was the mistress of the earth, the royal seat of the monarchs of the universe. Now that sovereignty must cease, and the eastern monarch Cambyses can pretend to no guarantee of his own, to no greatness of his own, but comes to borrow glories from the western world in seeking a patronage from your favorable goodness." The deployment of Persian history served particular, none too subtle, ideological purposes. In his short view of tragedy, published in 1693, the historiographer Royal, Thomas Rymer, drew an explicit parallel between the English defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 and the defeat of Xerxes' fleet by the Greeks in the sea battle at Salamis in 480 BC in the Persian Wars. A favorite topic for Restoration playwrights, ancient Persia was depicted from its rise through its corruption to its destruction at the hands of the European Macedonians, emphasizing such themes as the insatiable thirst for territorial expansion, the problem of over-centralization and tyranny, the corrupting influence of luxury, the corrosive effect of harem politics, and crises of succession. Plays like Nathaniel Lee's The Rival Queens from 1677, which concerned the Persian and Bactrian wives of Alexander the Great, or John Banks's Cyrus the Great, 1696, and Nicholas Rowe's The Ambitious Stepmother, 1700, about a later Parthian king named Arsaces and his exiled son, Artaxerxes, drew on both the classical sources and on historical syntheses by scholars like Samuel Clarke, John Ogilvie, and Samuel Pufendorf. Meanwhile, in Venice, operas based on the lives of the ancient Iranian kings and the fate of their empires were as popular as plays were in London. Luigi Mancia's Alessandro in Susa, which is set in one of Iran's most extensively excavated sites, premiered in Venice in 1676, while Alessandro Scarlatti's Cambyses, Cambisio, was performed in Naples in 1719. To put the popularity of Persian royal protagonists in perspective, no fewer than 58 operas about Artaxerxes I, 18 about Darius, and 2 about Xerxes were written and performed in Italy between the late 17th and the late 18th century. And you can see Xerxes at Glimmerglass this summer. In conclusion, Renaissance and early modern Europe learned about ancient Iran in a variety of ways, from notices in Herodotus and other ancient authors, from the travel accounts of visitors to Persepolis and other sites, and from plays and operas. And of course, this went hand in hand with a growth in knowledge about all things Persian, from classical Persian poetry, like Saadi's Golestan or Rose Garden, a French translation of which appeared as early as 1634, to silk and carpets, like the one shown in Vermeer's Young Woman with the Water Pitcher, painted in 1662, which hangs in the Met. although the decipherment of Old Persian cuneiform wasn't achieved until the 1840s, the first Western grammar of modern Persian was published in the Netherlands in 1639. We see then that the exploration of archaeological sites and monuments, their graphic documentation, and the dissemination of ideas about Persian antiquity via Herodotus and other authors, as well as accounts by European travelers, and dramas and operas focusing on ancient Persian kings, ran parallel to and were enmeshed with Europe's engagement with Iran for commercial and political purposes. Business people and diplomats rushing to Iran to sell Airbuses or negotiate nuclear non-proliferation treaties in the 21st century could learn a thing or two from the likes of 17th century travelers like Adam Olearius or Jean Chardin or Thomas Herbert. The ancient history and cultural heritage of Iran is not a quaint antiquarian topic of interest to only a few academics like myself. Over 65 million Iranians are passionate about their past, about their history, about their archaeology, and an appreciation of that would surely benefit those who are currently seeking to understand and negotiate with the government in Tehran. But that must be the subject of another lecture. For now, I thank you very much for your attention. Iran was a big producer. It probably also was producing silk already in late antiquity in the so-called Sasanian period. But how much earlier, we don't know. We know that in the preceding era, the period following the Persian Empire, the so-called Arsacid or Parthian period, there were diplomatic contacts. Chinese ambassadors came all the way to the Red Sea, and there were diplomatic contacts with the Roman Empire. So maybe somewhere in there, along the line, the Silk Road was introduced. Well,
and in the opposite direction, what were the Persians buying from the Western?
That's harder for me to say. One thing that they were interested in were arms. That's for sure. And that continues. Actually, the whole military side of things. Not this early day, but a little bit later, in the 19th century, becomes very interesting because there were many European officers from various countries who served there. There were foundries that made cannon and so forth. But silk was the big thing, and Shah Abbas used the supply of silk, or threatened withhold silk for political purposes. So, for example, he wanted the English and the Dutch to help him kick the Portuguese out of the Persian Gulf, and he wanted them to loan him ships for doing that, because he didn't have a navy. And he threatened holding back the silk. And another thing which is very interesting about the diplomatic side, more than the commercial side, is that there was an attempt, unsuccessful attempt, but there were discussions, and Shah Abbas himself was in favor of this, and maybe even had the idea, as one of his advisors did, that the Western powers should ally themselves with the Safavid Empire of Iran in a holy war against the Ottomans. So the Ottomans were the Safavids' big enemy, and he thought, maybe the Christians would also feel, Christian Europe would also feel inclined to join in. And they tried to make that kind of alliance, but which didn't really pan out. But there was an amazing amount of diplomatic contact. I mean, some of these people I mentioned were diplomats, but they're on different missions from different countries, Sweden, Germany, England, France. Later on, there are a lot more products, all kinds of things, natural things, drugs, and all sorts of things, pigment and ore, and all kinds of things came from Iran, but not really until the 18th century, as far as I know.
Turning to the east just for a moment, I don't want to disturb the between the West and Iran, but I mean, probably most people are familiar with the fact that the Islamic invasion, if you will, of India was a huge event in Indian history. But at what point did Zoroastrianism get taken over by Islam?
And of course, the sort of short answer is that practicing Zoroastrians were probably never a big majority in the Sasanian Empire, that is, at the time when the Islamic conquest came. It was a state religion. It was the religion of the ruling Sasanian dynasty. In some areas, but areas like Fars, near Persepolis, they have many, many fire temples, Zoroastrian temples. Other parts of Iran have fewer. There are other fire temples, other famous fire temples, Taqi Suleiman in Azerbaijan and elsewhere. But anyway, nevertheless, Zoroastrian, and although the Islamic conquerors, at least the rhetoric is that Zoroastrians are sort of, you know, pagans, basically. You know, you have Jews, you have Christians, you have Hindus, Buddhists, Zoroastrians. You've got a range of different peoples, different religions subject to the Islamic conquest. So, but Zoroastrianism continued to be practiced in pockets, which is why I mentioned that many of the bureaucrats exactly, but bureaucrats, secretaries, people who were literate, were often still Zoroastrians, certainly in Fars. And that came to an end. I can't tell you exactly. I think there are other people here who know much more about this than I do. But there was an event, a particular, I think, governor who particularly persecuted Zoroastrians, might have been in the 11th century, I kind of think. And then the Zoroastrians got sort of pushed aside, so that probably it was then, maybe a little bit earlier, but then that the exodus occurred of Zoroastrians to Bombay, Mumbai, which is the beginning of the Parsi community. But there are still Zoroastrians in Iran. Kerman and Yazd are the particular centers of Zoroastrianism, but there are temples elsewhere. So that's, it wasn't, you know, absolute with the Islamic conquest.
So if the Zoroastrian element, I mean the history of Sephardis could mark Zoroastrian,
yeah.
Is that a reason for the Islamic Orthodox not to have had much interest in Persia?
The thing is, we have so few sources that would be kind of relevant to that. Because Zoroastrianism, probably as a result of the Islamic conquest, but more probably as a result of the Mongol conquest, there is a real dearth of anything before the 9th century. So we don't have anything that would reflect really earlier Zoroastrian knowledge of who the builders were of Persepolis. It's just missing. And a lot is missing due to the kind of, yeah.
A quick question, Dan. You just came back from Kurdistan on Sunday.
Yeah.
What can you tell us in three sentences, 5 seconds,
yeah,
about Kurdistan?
Well, this is Iraqi Kurdistan, right? So Iraqi Kurdistan is functionally autonomous. It has borders with the rest of Iraq, so you can't just go blithely across. There are checkpoints and borders. So within Iraqi Kurdistan, things are very, very peaceful. There's been no kidnappings, no terrible events since the Gulf War, really, since 2003. And they are doing quite well. I think they were impacted very adversely by the drop in oil prices. But there's an abundance of food, and people are out, and it's calm, and it's, and what is remarkable to me, after having worked in Iran a lot and been to Armenia and Turkey and various places, is that people actually drive according to the rules of the road. So this is, within the Middle East, this is kind of unheard of. So there's a sort of calmness. There's not, people are not speeding everywhere and driving like crazy people. So, you know, I really have to say that you would never, ever realize that war was raging in Mosul. I mean, that's might as well be in Lebanon. Kurdistan is big enough to have several international airports, and Erbil is the biggest one, but Erbil is a lot closer to the action with ISIS. We flew into a more easterly one, which is where we're proposing to work, in Sulaymaniyah, and there are direct flights from Germany, and everything's organized, and everything's calm. It's very, very remarkable, really.
We were talking about the interaction of early and medieval Persia with Persia. I'm just wondering, you're focusing on Western Christianity. I was wondering about the Eastern
Christians,
and how different the experience of Eastern Christianity was in Persia
It's this kind of question about Christianity in Iran. By the time all of these people were traveling, there would have been very, very few Christians. There are very few Christians in Iran after the Mongol period. But before that, there were lots of Christians, and so much so that at the time of the Islamic conquest, the southwesternmost, just put up this old sort of like a joke map. This sort of southwestern bit of Iran, closest to Iraq, Mesopotamia, at the time of the Islamic conquest, is thought to have had a larger Christian population than, or let's say, Christians were in the majority. So this is Nestorian or Eastern Christianity. But we know about it from various sources. One are the acts of synods of the church. The headquarters of the church was located very close to modern Baghdad in Seleukia, Ctesiphon, And certainly from the early 5th century onward, you have the names of all the bishops who attended these big meetings. And so you know where the bishoprics were. And there are lots and lots of bishoprics going all the way into Central Asia, up into Sogdia. So Christianity was much more widespread, I would say it was particularly strong in the southwest, what is today Khuzestan and Fars, also to some extent in Media, in the sort of central western Zagros, and then in Central Asia. But it's really the Mongol invasion that kind of cuts that big time, so that by the 1670, well, okay, I have to qualify. When these travelers came to Isfahan, the capital of the Safavid Empire, the Christians they would have found, they did find Christians, I just said they were not. Yes, the Christians they found were Armenians, because Shah Abbas I moved many Armenians from here, right? This river, this is the core river, and there's a place called Julfa right on it. And he basically deported thousands of Armenians who were Christians to Isfahan to stimulate the economic life of the city. So if you go to Isfahan nowadays, there are small churches, and then there's a big, beautiful, amazing Armenian cathedral. I didn't really go into this because it's not really relevant to ancient ruins, but there were also attempts by Western Christian sort of organizations to convert and to sort of increase the message of Christianity in the Safavid capital. Most particularly, there were Carmelite monks there for a very long time in Isfahan. And a couple of the Carmelite monks were great authorities on everything contemporary. They weren't seemingly interested in antiquities, but they wrote a lot. There are a lot of Carmelite documents that talk about contemporary politics and social affairs. So yeah, they would have seen all of this.
You mentioned, if I can correct that, I misunderstood. Initially, the visitors, they were told that people didn't know who founded Persepolis, who built it. At what time did that begin to change? And how did they come to know more?
Well, the Persians didn't know. The Persians, as I said, they attributed it to Jamshid, who was a mythical king. But the Europeans had all of these classical sources that talked about Persepolis, they talked about the Persian Empire, talked about Alexander's destruction of Persepolis. So the thing that had to happen was for that archaeological site to be convincingly identified as ancient Persepolis. And that happened very early. As I mentioned, with Pordenone, he didn't use the name Persepolis, but by the time Barbaro was there in the late 15th century, I don't think any Europeans were in doubt that site was ancient Persepolis. There are other places, like Cyrus's capital, Pasargadae, where there was more debate in the literature as to whether this really is the site mentioned by Diodorus or Arrian or Herodotus. But I think Persepolis, they were pretty convinced early on. I don't honestly know who might get the claim credit for being the first to definitively say that. But I think they all pretty much. And as Chardin said, it was so easy with these books, Arrian and Diodorus and Quintus Curtius, to look at the ruins and say, oh yeah, I understand, that's what they're talking about. So it certainly happened early.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jan. For those of you who are bibliophiles, Dan Potts is prepared. manuscripts on the table to my right if you'd like to look at them before you leave. Thanks so much for coming.